If you're hoping for a session dedicated to the notion of playing with real people, then you're in the right place. My name is Andreas Schroeder. I'm the author of 22 books of fiction and nonfiction, and some of them actually play with real people. And I also hold the McLean Hunter Chair in Creative Nonfiction at UBC's Creative Writing Department. The first author I'm going to introduce is Annabel Lyon. Annabel hails from Vancouver, where she studied philosophy and English at SFU and creative writing and law at UBC. She's also studied a bunch of music in and around that time as well, and in fact earned some of her living giving music lessons during that time. If you really think about all those different areas of study, you might actually get the impression, certainly from today's perspective, that maybe she was she had a dead battery in her sort of career GPS or something like that. But you know, that's actually that's what a fully rounded education was considered, you know, just not very many years ago. And Annabel put it to very good use. She's the author of four works of fiction, a short story collection entitled Oxygen, which was nominated for the Danuta Gleed Fiction Award, a collection of novellas entitled The Best Thing For You, that was nominated for both the Ethel Wilson Fiction Prize and the City of Vancouver Book Prize. Then there was a juvenile novel entitled All Season Edie, and I believe there's a second volume in the works.
In the works, yeah.
And then, of course, her most recent novel, The Golden Mean, which she's going to talk about today. That's been shortlisted for, it's a triple-decker, for all three of Canada's top fiction awards, the Giller, the Writers' Trust Fiction Prize, and the Governor General's Award. The real person, because of course each one of these books has a real person in it, that is to say a historical figure, the real person in this novel is the philosopher Aristotle, who's also the book's first-person narrator. And by the way, I just wanted to tell you that, and I'll give you this for free, Aristotle's two kids in the novel, they're actually modeled on Annabel's own kids. Don't tell her I told you that, but that's in fact. So Annabel,
thank you. To the podium, Andreas. Or
sorry,
to podium. Or?
Wherever you feel most comfortable.
I'm good here. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming today. I'll just preface my reading very, very briefly by saying that we're in ancient Macedonia, northern Greece, 2,300 years ago. Aristotle has been asked by the king at that time, Philip, to stay away from Athens, to stay in the north, and tutor his two sons, Alexander, and Alexander had a half-brother who was mentally challenged, and he's having to make that decision here. That night I dream of Stagira. When I wake, I sit for a long time by the window, wrapped in a blanket, remembering. I was a miserable child, lonely and frightened when my father was called away at night or traveling, which was often. He was the only doctor for many of the little coastal villages, and as his reputation grew, he was called ever farther away to ever bigger towns. The twins were still allowed to sleep with our mother, but I had no one. I suffered night terrors until my mother taught me the trick of concentrating on whatever was closest to me, the length and texture of the hairs on the fur I slept on, or counting the threads of the pulse in my wrist, or feeling the tide of the breath in my body, and so distracting myself. She said this trick had helped her with the same problem. Soon I was practicing it everywhere I went, observing and analyzing and categorizing compulsively until no one wanted to talk to me because of the questions I asked and the information I spilled. Have you ever noticed? I would ask boys my own age. Can you tell me? I would ask adults. Soon I was spending all my time alone, swimming with my eyes open, trapping insects, reading my father's books, cutting myself to observe the blood, drawing maps, tracing leaves, charting stars. And all of it helped a little, and none of it helped a lot. On the worst days, I stayed in bed, unable to speak or eat, until the blackness lifted. He's a strange boy, I overheard my father tell my mother on one of his increasingly rare visits home. He worries me. Not his health, but his mind. I don't know if he has too much discipline or none at all. He goes places I can't follow inside himself. He misses you, my mother said. I watch Alexander more closely now. On the eve of Philip's departure for Thessaly, one early summer dawn, we ride out to hunt. I arrive in second-best clothes, unarmed, on slow, reliable tar. Philip and his entourage of pages and purple-cloaked companions are in full battle dress. The ground beneath their mounts roils with dogs. After some insults, it suggested I be made to wear a halter around my waist like a boy who hasn't had his first kill. I'm handed a spare pike and shield and left to keep up as best I can. We ride to the royal park where the day's festivities begin with the sacrifice of a screaming, spurting piglet. It's a day of pomp and etiquette that I see as a succession of frozen images like a series of coins struck and overstruck, glinting in the sun. Philip in profile, helmeted. A dog rearing up on hind legs as its owner unclips its lead. A spear balanced on a shoulder. A boar crashing through a clearing. Alexander unstraddling his horse, knife unsheathed. The boar shaking off a spear sunk too shallow in its side, kicking in the skull of a dog, crashing off again. The dog, one leg spastic. The dog, dead. A wineskin passed from hand to hand, Alexander looking for his mount. Philip begins to tease him, offering him a skittish horse, daring him to ride it. Oxhead, the animal is called, for the white mark on its forehead. The boy turns it toward the sun, blinding it, and mounts it easily. Philip, drunk, makes a sarcastic remark. From the warhorse's back, the boy looks down at his father as though he's coated in filth. That's the coin I'll carry longest in my pocket, the image I'll worry over and over with my thumb. I could help him, just like his brother. I could fill my plate. I could stay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Annabelle. Kate Braid. Now, if you thought that Milton Acorn was the last significant Canadian poet to swing a hammer in all seriousness, you'd be dead wrong. Kate Braid actually made her living for 14 years as a construction carpenter, starting in 1977, and she finally wrapped it up in 1991. That's the kind of poet you want to live next door to, right? I mean, poets have such reputations being so impractical. Well, not always. Anyway, after she wrapped that up, she, of course, she was writing poetry during that time as well, and prose too. So it actually makes more sense than it sounds like when after she wrapped that up, she began teaching creative writing. And she taught creative writing at SFU, UBC, and Vancouver Island University, all three. She's the author of a biography of the painter Emily Carr, as well as five collections of poetry, Covering Rough Ground, which won the Pat Lowther Award, To This Cedar Fountain, that was nominated for a BC Poetry Prize, Inward to the Bones, Georgia O'Keeffe's Journey with Emily Carr, which won the Vancouver City Book Prize, A Well-Mannered Storm, the Glenn Gould poems, and that's the one she's going to talk about today, and then also Turning Left to the Ladies, and that's specifically about her experiences in the construction industry, also a collection of poems that is also current at the moment. Now, obviously, the real person in The Well-Mannered Storm is the pianist Glenn Gould. Kate?
I'll read two poems. In this book, there are two voices. One is the voice of Glenn Gould, the pianist, one of Canada's greatest. And the other is the voice of a fan who begins writing to him when she randomly happens to hear the Goldberg Variations. Then loses her hearing and begins corresponding with Gould. And their two lives sort of reflect each other. So I'll read you one poem from each voice, and this first one is from Glenn Gould, called Becoming. I was six when my parents took me to my first piano concert, Joseph Hoffman. And in the car, coming home, half asleep, I heard orchestral sounds, and I was Hoffman. That's when I knew I could become another. And later, fishing, a living perch on my line, this thing, twisting extension of my breath, iridescence of sea and me. For the first time, I knew it from the fish's point of view. So when the neighbor raised his hand to kill it, I screamed and stamped my feet, almost tipped the boat until he let it go. I would die if he did not stop. I knew what we shared, that fish and I, more than breath. The way his body leaped, gray rainbow of scales, the brightness of his eye. Transformer, that's what I am. It's easy. I slip my edges like shedding a too large coat, thin skin, for another, larger, and I am lighter, the ghost of me, free to become Brahms, Webern, Bach, especially Bach. Where do you care to go? I can take you there. And secondly, the voice of the fan. She's been in some correspondence with him and has told him that her mom, among other things, was going in for surgery. Dear Glenn, my mom's cancer surgery went well, but yes, it's been a rough year. After her diagnosis, I went deaf in one ear. It happened overnight. A cold, my doctor said, and prescribed antibiotics, more antibiotics, and finally a hearing test. Permanent inner ear damage, the specialist said, and turned away. What does that mean? I've made an appointment with another doctor. Then, for some reason, I can't remember, I played your recording of the Goldbergs. I turned my right ear, the good one, to the speaker, and when the piece was over, I was curled in front of that speaker, crying. What did I hear? What did you say? What did Bach? That I had to listen again, over and over. Isn't it a miracle that when I lost half my hearing, Bach changed too? I dare to say, your friend, Kay.
Ooh. Beautiful. Thank you very much, Kate. Thomas Trofimuk, well, he was born and raised in Edmonton, and when I mentioned to a friend of mine who lives in Edmonton that we were going to be doing a session together, he said, oh, that's great. He said, Thomas is, and I'm going to quote here, a wonderfully off-the-wall loose cannon. And in case it's not clear, that was meant as a compliment. If you check out his website, you can kind of see where that notion comes from. I just sort of challenge you to do that. It's also probably therefore no accident that Thomas is the founding father of Edmonton's Raving Poets movement. We may have to ask him to explain that in greater detail. His poems and short stories have been published in literary journals all across the country. He's the author of 3 acclaimed novels. The first one, published in 2002, is entitled The 52nd Poem, and it won both the Alberta Novel of the Year and the City of Edmonton Book Prize. His second, which was entitled Doubting Yourself to the Bone, was published 4 years later and named one of the top 100 must-read books of 2006 by the Globe and Mail. And his most recent work, a novel entitled Waiting for Columbus, the one he's going to talk about today, the real person in it, of course, is the explorer and at least the putative discoverer of North America, Christopher Columbus.
Tom? Thanks. I'm going to stand up because my voice just works better when I stand up. So just a little preface. The book is about a man who wakes up in Seville, Spain, opens his eyes in the morning and believes wholeheartedly that he is Christopher Columbus. And I won't say any more about it because we'll be having a discussion. But I'd like to do something I've never done before, which is a little informal survey of the audience. How many here? Okay, you pick up a book and you're interested in the book, and you take it home, and there's a prologue. How many read it? How many don't read it?
Whoa.
Okay. I'll tell you a little story about my wife. She didn't put up her hand because she's too embarrassed, but she's one of those people that doesn't read the prologue. And as we've been touring across the country, I've been torturing her with reading her the prologue. So imagine a man standing on a rocky shoreline looking out to sea, pondering the question, the same question we whisper when we look up at night into a star-crazed sky, swirls of light, millions of years old, everything moving away or toward or around. What's out there? This man is an average guy except for this need he has when it comes to the ocean. He is a man who will go out of his way to stand on beaches and look out to sea. He will pull over to the side of the highway or a road. He will get off a train or disembark a bus and then stand at the edge of whatever ocean is there with his awe and wonder vibrating. Often, depending on how he feels, he will hum Barber's Adagio for strings. He thinks he remembers this music was one of the pieces played at JFK's funeral. He could be wrong about this, but it's easy for him to imagine this music, a military band playing regally, painfully, marching in front of a long line of black vehicles. It is the perfect music for the funeral procession of a president, and it is the ideal music for oceans. Oceans are big enough to handle the sorrow of Barber's Adagio. Sometimes the first notes of this music are just there in the back of his throat, waiting, ready. He begins to hum, and all the following notes seem to know what they must do to make the melody. It's raining. He's wearing a ratty, dark blue baseball cap that's seen better days. It's pulled down to his eyebrows as protection from the rain. He shakes his head, marvels at the redundancy of rain while standing next to an ocean. So much water just there in the rising and falling swells in the ebb and flow in wave after wave. So much water, and yet it rains. He smiles at the ocean. This is a desolate, rocky place. Its rocks seem old, as if they have been written down in an ancient, forgotten language. He read somewhere there were fossil beds along the shore. He does not doubt this. He inhales deeply, thinks, green, humid, incomprehensible. He glances up, squints through the streaky gray sky, and drifts back to the only question that matters. He knows he is not the first to stand in wonder at the edge of an ocean. Human beings across the spectrum of time have stood at the edges of things they couldn't comprehend and drifted in the mystery of not knowing. We no longer think of oceans as frightening, mysterious, or forbidding. Not today. We've lost our deference and awe for oceans because we are no longer dependent. We fly over them, look down from 35,000 feet, maybe notice a glint of sunlight or the way color dances. But this man can easily conjure up respect and even fear. He can easily muster a meditation on courage. He looks out and feels the ocean's coldness, understands the uncaring green and gray, the undulating deep heart of it. It takes courage to face the unknown with gusto. He wishes he didn't know about oceans. That way, he could be certain that he has courage. But you cannot erase your own knowledge, he thinks, so this rumination is only a game played by an idiot who fears the unknown. So that's the prologue, and I'm just going to, still good for time, so I'm just going to read just a snippet of the beginning so that you get an idea of my Columbus arriving. This is the Sevilla Institute for the Mentally Ill, Sevilla, Spain. The passage from freedom to incarceration is never an easy one. The passage from an unacknowledged, untested sanity to a diagnosed insanity is equally problematic. The first time Nurse Consuela Emma Lopez entered his world, it was with nervousness, with the trepidation of a sparrow pecking the ground a few meters in front of a perfectly motionless cat. He was immobile on the bed in the emitting area, restrained and drugged. He'd arrived at the Institute, kicking and screaming. Consuela heard the shouting, wondered who it was and what it was that had him so upset. She could have written this off as just another ugly, loud admittance in a long string of ugly and loud admittances. But the sound of someone in pain or distress always gets through to her heart. The sound of this man's voice caused her to pause, to look up from her work, and ache a little. The timbre of this particular voice vibrated in her. She cared immediately. This is not something she likes about herself. Not that there's anything wrong with caring. It's a good quality for a nurse. It's just that she wishes she were tougher, more thick-skinned. Consuela almost tiptoes into the room, slightly, silently, but not so timidly as to suggest she's uncomfortable in the admitting room. The lights have been dimmed and a curtain drawn around his bed. They've drugged him, she thinks. And they're waiting for the drugs to kick in. She peeks through a slit in the curtain. It's difficult to say how old he is, but she would guess 35, maybe 38, despite the graying verging on white hair. He has a kind, narrow face, but he's obviously been through something, some sort of trying experience or ordeal of some kind. There are bags under his eyes, and there are scratches, some deeper than others, across his forehead. His jaw has been bandaged. Consuela finds his chart hanging on the far wall, flips it open, and finds an exercise in ambiguity, scant details about where he was found, the words Strait of Gibraltar and Palos, no name, a notation on the sedative he'd been given, a hefty dose of Rohypnol, and a number. Nurses talk. They tell stories at coffee. 2 hours earlier, a black van had arrived and out had climbed three members of the National Police Force with the new patient wedged between them. They delivered him wrapped tightly in a straitjacket to the admitting area. His clothes were bloodstained, his shirt ripped. Despite the restraints, he was wild. He'd broken the nose of one policeman with a lurching headbutt to the face. They'd said something about his name being Bolivar and that he'd been found in the Strait of Gibraltar. In the Strait? A nurse asked. Surely you mean near the Strait. The policeman had looked at her with dehumanizing, flat disdain, signed the papers that were thrust toward him, dropped the pen on the counter, and departed quickly. It seemed that the transport and handoff of this patient had been a trying experience for these men. They were glad to be rid of him, and Consuela saw them as they were leaving and remembers thinking they were very serious, severe. If they'd had clowns in both pockets of their trousers, they wouldn't have smiled. They reminded her of her ex, the black, stiff uniforms, those intensely earnest faces, the type of men that followed orders unquestioningly. Thank you.
The use of historically real people in either poetry or fiction goes way back. I'm not actually sure how far back, but I mean, you could argue that the Bible makes liberal use of that sort of convention. You know, the use of anonymous people who write in the voice of or on behalf of known or real personages. In today's literature, it's all over the place. I mean, you can start off with something like, the first thing that popped into my mind when I was trying to think of examples was the cartoonist Gary Trudeau, right? He uses real political figures in imagined situations, mostly sort of for satiric purposes. I recently read the book *The Untouchable* by John Banville, which is clearly, the first-person narrator is the British counter-spy Anthony Blunt, and the entire book, written in the first person, presents Blunt's life. Not the exciting spy stuff, but the sort of domestic context for it, all written as if it was written by Anthony Blunt himself. Kate Braid's collection, the poetry collection, Inward to the Bones, Georgia O'Keeffe's Journey with Emily Carr. Kate found out that Emily Carr and Georgia O'Keeffe actually did briefly meet at one point in New York City, and then she imagined a journey for them, which only happened in her imagination, but not inconceivable, and so that's another example. And then, I mean, we know that Adolf Hitler and Sigmund Freud never actually met, but they do in a movie called The Mirror. I'm not sure whether that helped society much or not. But anyway, that's what happened. It's a ghastly movie. Don't bother with it. But anyway, so the use of real people in fictitious or semi-fictitious situations and the motivations for using them in that way is obviously very complex and wide-ranging. So I'm going to just jump straight in with my first and very obvious question to our authors. And I'm going to ask you first, Kate, what made you decide to use a historical figure in your book, and what literary advantage or benefit do you feel you gained from it, assuming that that's what you felt you did?
Well, I started by just writing the poems and wondering why, because I don't, at that time, I did not like classical music, and I particularly did not like Bach. So it was a bit of a mystery, but when I thought back, a few weeks before had been September 25th, 2002, which had been Glenn Gould's, would have been his 70th birthday. He actually died very young when he was in 1982, when he was 50. And so on that day, I happened to be in the car, and all day CBC, blessings on them, played interviews with Glenn Gould, interviews with people who knew him, and mostly played his music. And I thought, well, this is an interesting guy. I didn't know anything about him. And that was the end of that. At the time, also, in retrospect, I realized my life was falling apart. There had been huge losses in my life. There had been job loss and terrible illness, and including I had lost my hearing in one ear. And then I was watching a video of jazz, Cuban jazz, and out popped this poem about I prefer classical music to jazz. And you know a line when you hear one after a while, so I wrote the line down, and I kept, by the end of the video, I had the first poem, and they just kept coming. And then I got more and more curious, of course, and followed it up with research. I thought about this question. Andreas sort of tipped us off. The question of literary advantage, I actually think it's been a disadvantage to write about a real person. I've had several journals refuse to publish the poems because they said it's been done before. Nobody wants to hear another voice of someone, poems of. And so it's actually, I don't think it's done me any good, at least poetically. But I did it anyway.
Okay. Annabelle?
I didn't set out to write a novel about Aristotle. I think the material really kind of came to me. I was a philosophy major as an undergrad, and I loved ethics, and I loved ancient philosophy. And when you put those two together, out pops Aristotle. And I would continue to read his work even after I stopped studying philosophy. September 11th, 2001 came along, and I went through what I think a lot of people in the arts went through, questioning what I was doing as a fiction writer, if that had any relevance in the world, you know, and all of those sorts of questions. Remember, we all used to talk about the end of irony, like we were all very serious all of a sudden. And I did what I often do in times of stress, which was that I would pick up my Aristotle and just, you know, dip in and read a little bit, because I think perhaps I got what you got from Bach, which was a sense of just a calm and an order and a sort of a reordering of things that had been, that had seemed chaotic. And I read the little bio in the front of my little Penguin Classic edition and thought, how would I structure that into a novel? And almost for fun, I started doing that and found that I couldn't leave it alone. I kept coming back to it and coming back to it. And the question of literary advantage for me, it actually was a huge advantage to work from a real person with a real life, with a biography where the outlines at least were known. For all that it's 2,300 years ago, we roughly know where he was, when, and what he was doing. I'm a short story writer, and to venture beyond 20 pages for me is a massive undertaking. That's, you know, I need to pack, like, for a trip to Everest to try and do that. You know, it's just, it's so hard. And so to have been able to go into the novel with a structure in place, because I knew I wanted to write about a particular sort of discrete 7-year period, and so I got my start, and I've got my end, and I've got, oh, the exciting things that happened in the middle, so I could kind of structure it around that. And I stayed very close to that outline from the beginning of writing, you know, from October 2001 to the book now. You know, the outline hasn't changed. I had that framework to pour myself into, and to get to a lot, to a big distance, to go over 200 pages when I'm used to 20 pages, you know, to have those sort of marks to aim for me was very, very helpful. So I don't know how people just make novels up out of whole cloth, you know? Like, I would just give up and go back to writing short stories.
Tell her, Thomas.
Yes.
How's it going?
Tell me.
You know, Columbus started as an exploration of obsession. I 15 years ago, I thought, wow, I want to write something about obsession. I thought, you know, is it going to be big or is it going to be little? I don't know. But he seemed like a natural. You know, here's the guy that all the, you know, in my reading, all the best minds of his time, all the best scientists of his time told him that he was an idiot, that there's no way he could make it to the Indies. And in fact, if he hadn't accidentally run into North America, we wouldn't know about Columbus. He'd be just this guy that got three boats and disappeared. Mm-hmm. So it started off as an exploration of obsession, and then it changed. The story, the full story. I wrote 35,000 words, and I hit the wall. I said, "Well, there's no story here. I mean, I like this stuff, but there's no story." And so, you know, being a good little writer, you put it in the drawer, and you keep pulling it out every 3 years and reading it and screaming in from the other room to your wife or your husband's, "Gee, honey, this is brilliant!" And then putting it back in the drawer.
No answer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's silent in there. Yeah, so part of the process about 3 years ago was to do this exercise I do with my kids at I teach at a writing camp in Alberta at Bright Creek, and I asked them to imagine the ten worst things that they can think of to do to their character, to happen to their character, and so they do. They take 10 minutes, and I have to take death off the table because they're teenagers, and so they do, and then they have their lists, and I say, "Well, now I want you to ramp it up and imagine three more awful things," and they do that, and then I say, "I want you to make one of those three awful things happen to your character," and it's not the only way to start writing, but it's just a good way to get the juices going, and so I did that. I had this scenario, I had this writing on Columbus, and I'd read a lot of books, and I did it to myself. I thought of the worst thing that could possibly happen to me as a father of an 8-year-old. And I began to write. Put my head down and wrote. And so, in one sense, this is probably the most deeply personal book I've written. It deals with my anxieties, my fears, all my fears. And so in that process, Columbus became a delusion. He moved away from strictly historical character, and he became a delusion of a character. So,
well, that's fat.
That's so, a long answer, that's right. No.
So none of you actually set out to choose your character right off the bat. The character
Not really.
Sort of chose you.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So once you were chosen, what methods did you use? I mean, the obvious thing, obviously, you know, whatever might have been written by your characters and so on, you would immerse yourself. But did you use any less conventional methods of kind of getting into the head of your character to try and understand your character more? Did you channel them in some way, or you know, what do you think, Kate?
That word channel keeps coming up. We got together as poets at the League of Poets a few years ago and talked about people who do first person, and we all studiously avoided the word channel. But writers do talk about feeling like the writing is a given, and that sometimes you go, "Where did that come from?" And literally, so it's tempting to use that word. And in my case, where I knew nothing about music, I'm not a musician. That was hard, but the way I fed it was with research. I did more research for this book than any book that I've done. I started by reading his biographies. I kept feeling something was missing, and now this was before Kevin Bazana's wonderful biography, Wondrous Strange. Something was missing. The only clue I had to it was one biography refers in one sentence to him possibly having Asperger's syndrome, which is high-functioning autism, which rang a bell for me. 2 weeks later in the paper, there was a huge headline or article about an Asperger's conference. One of the things that happened in this book was extraordinary coincidence, over and over and over, where I felt, speaking of channeling, like I was being led. So I went to this conference. I explained before I went that... It was a conference for and by people with Asperger's or with autism, and I explained that I didn't. I phoned and I said, "I don't have autism or in my family, but I'm doing research. I have this hunch that maybe Glenn Gould had autism," and there was dead silence. And I thought, oh dear, I've offended her in some way. This woman had Asperger's. And she said, "You know, when people come to our school, mostly they bring their children to find out if their children are autistic. And she said the first thing we do to show them typical body language of autistic people is we play them CBC's Life and Times of Glenn Gould.
Oh.
So I said, you think I'm on the right track here? So things like that happened with my research, and I really felt like I followed along. So I read all the books. Kevin Bazana's, I felt, was by far the best. But even Kevin Bazana, we now have this ongoing thing, did he or did he not have autism? I mostly, though, listened to his music. I listened and listened and listened, and I listened to all the variations of each piece of music that he played. And toward the end, I went to Ottawa and I went to Toronto and interviewed people who worked with him. Lauren Tulk, for example, was his technician for 20 years. Wonderful man who spent a day with me around Toronto. And then I think maybe the single most powerful thing for me was going to the National Archives and being able to see Gould's own notes, especially toward the end of his life. I was trying to put together what happened. And it was deeply moving to go through. He kept journal, sort of, you know, those big yellow sheets of, you know, foolscap. He kept those sort of journals toward the end, a few last few years of his life, and he would start a sentence and then flip to the next page, and he'd write one word and flip to the next page and write several more words. And the pain of him was extraordinary, which gave me several more poems about him disintegrating, fracturing at the end of his life. So that's a long answer, too.
No, it's fascinating.
Good answer.
Yeah. Annabelle, did you, I mean, other than Aristotle's writings, were you able to find anything from other sources, too?
Well, I was just thinking that I was probably more fortunate than either Kate or Thomas in that what's actually known about Aristotle is very, very little is known for real. And, you know, you can find all the primary sources, and for Alexander too, for that matter, and go back and read, you know, the contemporary ancient biographers, and you can get to the end of that. You can come to the end of the research and then see what's sort of blank canvas that you then need to fill in, whereas I'm guessing you guys, the research could go on forever. I couldn't go interview anybody. You know what I mean? Like, there was just, I could see where the wide open space was. But then, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and I found what I think was happening with me was that contemporary events would start to come and fill in, and I started to find that things happening in the news and just other books that I was reading, things would feed in and inform me. And I'll give you two examples, one kind of trivial and one less so. I read that book, The 100-Mile Diet by Lisa McKinnon and the other fellow whose name I'm forgetting right now, but and that really helped me out as I was working on this, because I thought, yeah, of course Aristotle would have been on the 100-mile diet. You know, this is what they... But, you know, it could help me correct mistakes. I gave them, for instance, I gave them a meal of roast lamb in autumn.
Mm-hmm.
So they got goat instead, because there's no lambs in autumn, right? But it really made me think about, you know, seasonal availability and what the diet would have been and stuff like that from the freaking 100-mile diet, right? It helped. That was my trivial example. The more significant one, when I was coming to terms with the character of Alexander, and he was a real struggle for me, because we have not a lot that's written, you know, from his time about him, but we have a great mythologizing tradition that has built up over the centuries since. And, you know, we had this in the popular culture, you know, and going back to like medieval times when there were these Alexander romances, these stories that were told about him where he practically was Superman, right, with cape and tights, and he could do magic tricks. And, you know, he was always considered, you know, a genius and brilliant and sexy and powerful and, you know, could do all of these things. And I knew that I didn't want to create an Alexander like that. And I also knew that it didn't seem entirely true to what is known of him, because there were contemporary accounts that he had fits of violent rage, he suffered headaches and alcoholism, would go to his tent and not come out for a week, once killed a close friend in just a blind rage. Once he left Greece to go on his campaigns, never turned around and came home. Couldn't leave the battlefield, he just kept going and going and going. And I was, of course, as we all were, coincidentally, you know, at the same time, reading about soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan suffering post-traumatic stress. And you look at those symptoms, they're identical. And I thought, well, why would it be any different just because he happened to be a soldier 2,300 years ago? You know, soldiering is soldiering, and what you suffer from that has to be the same. So, again, a long answer to a short question, but I found that I reached a point with the book where everything that was going on in contemporary terms seemed to reflect back to that, and that would mirror it right back again. Mm-hmm. And it became a very current contemporary feeling project for me for all that it set that long ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I can see that. Could you use that approach, Thomas, and with Columbus? Because, I mean, he didn't, other than his fake logbooks, there's really not a whole lot.
Well, you know, surprisingly, there were, I probably read 15 books on Columbus and then had to stop. And I wasn't even scratching the surface. Okay. And so that's a good thing. But, to counterbalance all that information was that hardly any of them agreed. And the good side of that is that gives me a lot of freedom as a writer of fiction to just make it happen, make it be. Where did he arrive? I just read a story in the Globe and Mail 2 weeks ago, just tiny little story buried, I don't know, somewhere in there, that said that they proved with DNA testing that he's from Spain. You're not from Genoa.
Yeah.
You know, and there's perfectly rational theories in a couple of these books that he's from Portugal. There's even a theory that he's from Britain. It's good to have that much information, but I had to stop reading.
Okay, well, given the sort of ambiguity of a lot of the information one is working with, then I wonder if you feel that, did you ever feel that there was you were banging up against an ethical issue at all, that it's possible that you would start misrepresenting your character in some important way? I was just thinking of, for example, Wayne Johnson, the Colony of Unrequited Dreams, right? The Joy Smallwood. Joy Smallwood in that novel is fairly accurate, but he gets given a mistress. There's a long affair, right, with a woman called, a journalist called Fielding. And I gather that the Smallwood family just hit the roof, right? I mean, there's sort of moral issues immediately. His reputation is defamed and so on. Did you feel like you were taking any chances along that line? Okay.
I tried to stay, because it was first person, it was important for me. It felt like, I was transposing myself, so I tried to stay as true as I could to the facts, which is one reason why I did so much research. The other reason was because everything I found out seemed to feed the poems, and I would get more poems, but... In the end, I just had to trust myself as a writer that I knew sometimes I was taking chances. Many people who read this have said how it personalizes Gould. And that's, I guess, not exactly what I intended, but of course that would come out of it, because I wanted to have a sense of who he was, and I just had to trust that I was reading the cues right. And know that if I read them wrong, other people have written and will write about him, and maybe that's what creates, I mean, we'll never know. The issue of autism I did specifically deal with, and I did write one poem, which I think luckily wasn't that good, about him talking about his autism. And then I thought, this isn't about him, whether or not he had a mental illness. Mm-hmm. It was, or a disability, however you see autism, or a different ability. It was just about him as a musician and as a human being trying to live in the world in his own body and in his own head. So I didn't put the poem in, and I didn't pursue that at all. I thought, it's really not relevant. He wouldn't have cared. Especially at his time, when most of his life they didn't even, I don't think they even had a name for it, for Asperger's anyway. So in the end, I guess it was just, I just trusted myself, and I trusted my relationship with Glenn that this would be, there would be some truth in it.
Mm-hmm. Annabelle, did you run into any issues like that?
I did feel an obligation to be as true to the historical record as I could, but that was partly, largely because going into it, my project with the novel was that I wanted people to know who he was. And I thought, he's a name that we know, but we don't really know what to associate with that name anymore beyond, white marble busts somewhere in a museum. Mm. We don't really know what it was that he accomplished. And so I wanted people to know that. So I didn't want to be twisting it up in the process and just confusing people and sort of delivering false goods, In the one instance in the novel where I did deviate significantly from the historical record, I plopped him down in the middle of one of the great battles of the ancient era. As a medic, you know, he gets to observe. I do say in the acknowledgments exactly where I put in something that I had made up, and I also list in the acknowledgments the characters who are fictional and which are real, because it just was important to me with this particular book that people sort of know what was true.
Now, I guess in your case, Thomas, that really doesn't apply.
I felt no obligation to get anything about Columbus right. And, you know, a lot of it is right, because, you know, I did do the research, and so a lot of the stuff around him is right. Now, I mean, I felt a moral obligation, an obligation as a human being to get the disease right, the dissociative identity disorder. And so my research on that is pretty thorough, and I consulted with the head of psychiatry at U of A, but that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about our characters, so no obligation to get Columbus right. But